All right, ladies and gentlemen, if you are hearing this, you have once again in tune to the Consequence of Habit podcast. This is your host, JT, and I'm going to officially say that this is season two. I think it's a convenient thing since I took about 3 weeks off from putting out an episode, and that is not because I was slacking off. Well, maybe a little bit, but truth be told, I've been working my tail off on the nonprofit side. You know, I've been talking about this nonprofit for some time now with... I probably wouldn't have mentioned it so early on, but I had no idea how long this stuff takes. But I am proud to announce that we're officially up and running. We are now a 501c3. We are planning our first events, and we are revamping what the idea of Consequence of Habit. Well, I mean, not the idea. That's fake news. We are revamping the type of impact that we want to have. You know, this thing's morphed. This started off as a podcast. It started off as me just yapping on a mic about my own journey. And then it evolved. It became something bigger. It became a platform for others to come on and tell their story on how habits have impacted their mental health, their success, and the environment. There's this culmination of stories. This is a year and a half of people coming on here. And if we're not trying to synthesize that information and do something with it, do something more with it than these individual episodes, then we're missing the mark. So as this thing evolves, we are now holding events. We're going to do something more. We're going to try and take all this information, and we're gonna try and build what my friend Chris Norris says, connection, purpose, and challenge. So I'm happy to announce that we're going to be holding our first event. We're going to have a speaker come in. We're going to have somebody come in. It could be me. I don't know. We're going to see how much money we have. And we're going to talk about the power of habit. We're going to talk about examining what we do on a daily basis and trying to decide if this is something that adds value to your life or is it compromising the person you could be. And after a short talk, where hopefully we all kind of take a look in the mirror, we're going to do something bigger than us. We're going to give back. We're going to do some service work. You know, this concept of doing something that's going to be around longer than we are. Something good. The world can seem like it's falling apart. As I'm saying this, it's a shitstorm in Afghanistan. COVID is rearing its ugly head yet again. Politically, we're a mess. Environmentally, not good. So we're going to do something. We're going to start with something we can control. And that is ourselves, our own habits, our thought processes. And then we're going to give back. We're going to give back to the earth. We're going to give back to the community, to we're giving back to it all. And we're gonna try and make a connection between that feeling of doing something bigger than us and an increased sense of self. We want to connect these actions with emotions. And it sounds out there, man, but there's something to it. And that leads me into this week's guest. Well, guests, plural. This week we are joined by Laura and Fred Johnson. Fred appeared on the radio show The Moth. Great show where people kind of go on. These are storytellers. And when I see storytellers, it is not fiction. This is, these people have lived these things. Fred talks about his experience with PTSD and what it was doing to his life. And he does it in such a great way. He uses humor. I mean, he's a funny dude. He's a great storyteller. I promise you, if you listen to this, one, you're going to laugh. And two, it is going to be thought provoking. You will have a deep compassion for what our veterans have gone through and continue to go through. Now, I was super stoked to find out that Fred's wife, Laura, is a psychologist. She's a veteran. She's a head of behavioral health at Fort Knox. So to hear this thing from a couple different standpoints, one, you've got Fred himself, who's has that lived experience. And then you have Fred's wife, who not only sees this through the eyes of a spouse, somebody who loves this person and is struggling to deal with the ramifications of PTSD. But also comes in with this professional and educational accolades that deals with this stuff every single day. I mean, not in her own household. So she has to toe these two lines. And I thought it was fascinating to kind of hear both their sides of it. And I'm super stoked that they both agreed to come on at the same time. I mean, this is personal stuff. So huge shout out to them. And full disclosure, Laura has now signed on as an advisor to the nonprofit. I walked away from this conversation so excited about both their vulnerability and their outlook on this, and then just seeing what Laura's, where she works and what she does, and I can just tell, man, she's perfect for what we're doing. She was gracious enough to say yes to this, and is now a big part of what we're doing and will continue to be in the future. So that's enough for me. Please welcome to the podcast, Fred and Laura Johnson. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for tuning in again to the Consequence of Habit podcast. I am here with Mr. Fred and Laura Johnson. I should say Dr. Laura Johnson, PhD. So first of all, thank you guys for agreeing to come on and having this conversation.
Yeah, but thank you, JT, for having us as well. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
So I'm gonna tell you how I even came across you and your story, and actually both your stories. I had another veteran who just hit me up. He's a friend of mine. He knows what the podcast is about. He's heard some of the other episodes, and he said, "Hey, you should look into getting this guy on." And he says, "There's this radio show called The Moth," and I'd heard of it and I'd listened to it before in these short stories. And he said, "Start it at minute 110," and I heard it, and it was probably 10 seconds from the time I finished that till I was searching your name up on LinkedIn and was happy to find you. If you could just walk us through, and I'm going to have a link to your talk, and if you could just give a brief synopsis on one, what you covered in that, and then two, how that segment even came to be in the first place.
Yeah, well, the story began on September 12, 2013, and it was just after the anniversary of 9/11, and that's kind of a difficult time for a lot of veterans. And I've been struggling through some things. I've been back from Afghanistan for about a year, then the Iraq tour. But I had been struggling with some things that happened. We can talk about it later in the show. But it had to do with my combat experience, and I lost a soldier, Sergeant Freeman Gardner. And I felt like I was responsible for it. So that had been weighing on me. And so I had decided, September 12th came. I missed September 11th because we had some work to do. I had several drinks, and I decided that I was going to drive my car into the Ohio River. I live here in Louisville. I was actually over in Indiana. And by the grace of God, I was stopped by a police officer who put me in jail. And I spent the night in jail. And the next morning, I called Laura. And before I could say anything, she says, "Either you're going to therapy now, or you'll never see me or your daughter again." Yeah. And so that was the beginning of my recovery, if you will, or my journey of becoming, facing my challenges. And then, in my opinion, I think I've done a good job of overcoming them. There's still things I have to work on, but that's kind of the synopsis of the story. And again, my wife's Dr. Laura Johnson's, I'll let her talk about her piece, but she's a psychologist, director of behavioral health at Fort Knox. So,
but I don't know anything when it comes to my husband, right? Me telling him that I thought therapy would be a great idea prior to this was just poo-pooed. Apparently we wasted all that money and all my years of, research, but you can't tell your spouse some things. I mean, and this is the interesting thing I find myself when I'm working with other patients. They'll end up there because I get a lot of patients that say, "Well, my wife said I had to come in."
Right.
But they don't believe they have to come in. They're fine, right? They're just checking the block.
Yeah.
And I think that sometimes it takes these really profound consequences to highlight that maybe we do need help. And I think the military, I talk about it all the time with, you just don't go, if you're sick in the military, you still go to work.
Right.
If you twist your ankle, you still go to work. I mean, you were in the Air Force, and, I can't tell you how many times I tightened my bootstraps so I could, keep going on the march or something. You just never, there is no physical illness that is going to stop us. So, my God, there's certainly not going to be a mental illness that would.
Well, and Laura, real quick, explain, because I think this really plays a key part. Explain what it is you did at that point, as far as in the as a doctor practicing. What was your position?
Well, I had known. I found out that he had been held overnight in the jail, because a buddy, not a buddy, a jail buddy, memorized my phone number because he was getting out earlier, and memorized my phone number and called my cell at like 9:30 in the morning and said, "You don't know me, don't hang up. I know where Fred is."
Okay.
And that poor man just—I can't remember who he is. I owe him money because I was like unleashed on him.
Yes.
And he thought it was good practice for what his wife was going to say to him. But I just—I was so angry, and I just because I thought I was angry and I was embarrassed. I'm a psychologist. I run mental health at Fort Knox, and my primary patient wasn't taking my advice.
Yeah.
So I was angry and I was worried. I was terrified. And I was very embarrassed. So
sure.
All that, I got to sit with that until he got released and he called me. And he said, this is, you know, I just dropped our daughter off at some kind of, tutoring. I dropped her off at the university for tutoring. And I'm in the car and I'm like, "You're not talking. No, this is how this goes. You have lost your vote. This is I'm the voting member. This is how this goes. You're going to get help or you're going to get a new address. And it's non-negotiable."
Yeah.
And I think I was, you know, I think I'm kind of a hardcore person, but I was terrified. You know, you're shaking when you're saying these things.
Sure. Sure. Now, really what stood out to me, well, there's a lot, but one of the first things, Fred, that stood out to me about your story is one was delivery, right? I mean, there's a message to come across here. And my own experience is a lot of times when talking about this, this has always been a defense mechanism for me. If I'm talking about something that's difficult, I add humor. And I've done it since I was a little kid. And I'm telling you, man, it lowers barriers, first of all. And your opening lines of that talk they were fantastic. Comedically, they were great because I think everyone was there's something about where people don't know how to react. They're laughing and then you hit them with the message. And if there's a way to drive something home, man, you nailed it. So I want to walk through because I probably listened to it three or four times coming back from the airport today. And there was a couple things that you had said. First, let's get into, before I even get there, I'm getting ahead of myself. You get to that point in your life and that you're at a crossroads and what was considered a kind of a rock bottom moment will go on later to be a blessing, right? Like this is the obstacle is the way. What was the journey after that? How did that start and what was a time frame before you start seeing like, oh man, I've needed this for a while?
Yeah, well, once Laura kind of woke me up, and again, she had told me for a while, you know, that sure. that I was my anger and that, you know, there are things that were not right. And my daughter was very vocal. My daughter's a mental health professional as well. She's going to be a psychologist. So, you know, they were very invested in me, but I just wasn't listening to it until I had this bottomed out moment, you know, and like, not only was I ashamed of myself, you know, I was ashamed for my family. Sure. I mean, I was a senior, I was a colonel in the United States Army. I got arrested for DUI. You know, my career was in jeopardy, but more importantly, my family was in jeopardy. You know, I felt like I was going to lose everything. So at that point, Laura really sat down and said, okay, this is the plan. This is what we need to do in order to, you know, I had to see, you know, I went and see a psychologist. Then saw a psychiatrist about medication because I had been like, I would never take medication. You know, there was nothing wrong with me. You know, you don't get sick serving your nation. And I just finally said, hey, I got to figure this out because I don't have control. And so I went to the psychologist and then the psychiatrist. I started meds. But then I started a program through a social worker at the VA. And I have great admiration for the people at the VA, particularly this social worker, Cindy Raminger, who I went through prolonged exposure with. And with prolonged exposure, Laura can give you the actual details, but essentially what you do is you relive the episode that was traumatic. And then through that, the discovery learning, if you will, or, you know, the cognitive expression of what you felt at the time, you you become more well. And I, again, Laura can explain the psychological aspects of it, but the bottom line, it was the hardest thing that I'd ever done, reliving the incident where I had given an order where a soldier got killed. Right. And that was kind of the impetus to my, to my problem. But the prolonged exposure helped. And that, I think that was the turning point. Well, first the medication kind of, stopped the bleeding, and then the prolonged exposure and the continued therapy gave me the, gave me the means to get better. And then that's when I started doing the storytelling. You know, I started a program called Shakespeare with Veterans. I wrote a book. So I did a bunch of, things for myself that, they started to restore hope, and that's kind of what, is where I'm at now as a middle school teacher in Louisville, Kentucky,
You I don't want to say glazed over, but there was something that you said in your moth talk, and you covered a little bit. You start getting these tools to help you along the way, and you have an incident with an altercation with another colonel, and the subject of medication was brought up. And I think the line you use is, "I don't need that. I'm a soldier. I'm disciplined." And I just from, we talked before we hit record, we talked about a conversation with Major General Greg Martin. It's that philosophy or how mental illness or just any, how trauma affects people. It's that stigma of discipline can beat this. And just that's always is like saying, hey, discipline's going to beat my diabetes, or discipline's going to be, name the cancer, whatever it is.
No, absolutely. And it's neurochemistry. Right. I mean, so our bodies, so it's when trauma affects our ability to produce and absorb those different neurotransmitters, serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, and we've got this cortisol surging through our bodies, and so we're in this heightened state, and discipline, you can't discipline yourself neurochemically,
right?
You can go for a run and you might produce more serotonin, but if you can't absorb it because your brain chemistry has changed, you can produce it all day long, it's not going to change. And that medication allows the body more time to absorb it.
Yeah.
So it gives you that ability to actually start to feel better neurochemically so that you can put these other habits into place. Because that's the other thing. There's not a drug out there. There's not a prescription medication or a liquid, beverage that will make the trauma go away.
Yeah.
So, we've got to medicate to get the neurotransmitters, the neurochemicals environment, our brain and our gut producing and absorbing, but then you have to have those other skills to put in place to overcome it. And the thing about trauma is we don't store a memory that's traumatic the same way we store other memories. If you think about trauma as putting your, if you think about memories as like a photo album, not that anyone has those anymore, but like your Facebook wall. Those photos are nice and they just fit nicely and, the trauma memory is this one that's been bunched up and it's crumbled because you're trying to get rid of it, and it just keeps popping up. And so you don't know if it happened 2 years ago, if it's something you think might happen next week. So we just kind of stay, in that heightened state, and anything can trigger it. We just never store that memory properly. And that's where the prolonged exposure comes into place, because it takes the emotional connection out of it. It's that desensitization to the event. Where you can actually logically look at it.
Is it almost like a stress inoculation of just going through this over and over, so you don't have those same chemical reactions to it?
I can see where we would have a lot of similarities there.
Okay.
Right? Especially after the fact, obviously. Mm-hmm. And the thing about trauma is we forget critical pieces.
Yeah.
Right? And so we're storing these memories, and a significant impact of trauma means we're not going to remember it all. And when you calm down, slow down, and you tell the story, and you take that emotion out, you see things and remember things that are critical to the story and help explain why we behaved in this particular way and help explain it. And our body has one job, and it's to keep us alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so we respond in very different ways when we are under lethal threat.
Yeah. And so like in what Laura just said, it's reminded me of, you know, that point whenever I was telling the story about how Freeman was killed. Again, I need to tell that story real quick, is that Freeman Gardner was a 27-year-old sergeant, communication specialist in a strike brigade. I was battalion commander, and we were doing a clearing mission in Baghdad, and the company commander came up and said, hey, I don't feel really good about this mission. I don't have enough intelligence. We need to, you know, I need more time. And I said, hey, no, you got to roll. And he, you know, roll they did. They got to a point in Amarillo neighborhood, which is a really bad neighborhood, and they didn't have enough people to pull security. So Freeman, being the kind of person he is, raised his hand and said, hey, I'll pull security. He got out of the vehicle, set up, and a few seconds later, he was an IED roadside bomb exploded and killed him instantly. And then, you know, we brought Freeman's body back to medical facility, preparing him to go back to the United States. And we all got around and we all, you know, said something. And I went down and I kissed Freeman's forehead. And when I came up, I saw the company commander. And at that point I said, I caused this. But in reliving, you know, and then I dealt with all that, but in prolonged exposure, I recalled things about that whole incident. You know, what happened in the talk to Tactical Operations Center when I gave that order. There's a lot more going on.
Sure.
And so eventually through, you know, the prolonged exposure, I remembered, you know, I started to break down the whole sequence of events. Still felt bad about what happened, but there was really nothing I could do. And I finally came to the conclusion, you know, bad things happen, you know, to good people, and that's what happened to Freeman. And that I needed to forgive myself for it, because I'm not the first commander to have lost a soldier. And, you know, I certainly won't be the last, but sometimes bad things happen. But the prolonged exposure helped me break that down. And it was a game changer for me.
What was it, the shame or the feeling of guilt that made you only remember the things that put you most responsible for it?
So the shame was that, you know, I felt responsible. So this idea of moral injury versus PTSD, you know, I know PTSD is in the DMS-5, and there's a lot of, you know, discussion about moral injury, but I felt really that I was ashamed of what I did. I felt guilty about it, and that shame is really what pushed it down. But I had PTSD. I think anybody that goes to combat and experiences combat has PTSD for some period of time. And again, I'm going to defer to the expert on this. I'm not a psychologist. My wife is. So, you know, you can...
I don't think anyone goes to combat and comes back unchanged. I don't think we go to kindergarten and come back unchanged. You know, there's stress. It's a stressful situation. And it's usually an acute stress situation. And then most people are able to come back. And I do say most people are able to come back and the stress normalizes and releases. But, you know, when there's shame involved, you know, we do a really good job. I mean, we're all junior lawyers. We collect the evidence for whatever we want to support. So, like, if I want to eat a bunch of hot dogs and pizza, I'm going to collect all the evidence that says this is really healthy. Mm-hmm. You know, I deserve this. So if we feel shame, we even unthinkingly start to collect the evidence that says we behave shamefully. And then we feel bad about ourselves, which is shameful. So it just becomes this very self-feeding event, and it's very difficult to break that. And that's where we start moving from the acute stress into more prolonged stress into a more, you know, pathological environment.
You know, it's funny, Fred, you said in the in part of this, you came to the realization that you don't have control. And these are that statement. Or even the admitting that, I mean, if you go into like a 12-step program, that is like the first thing you say is you know, I'm no longer in control of this right now. And when I connect that to shame, it is, man, I mean, it was my world, right? Coming from alcohol misuse and everything that goes along with that. And it's this tornado of, now I feel this way. So what am I going to do to feel better? And I'm going to self-medicate. I'm going to do things that give me these little dopamine hits to keep me somewhat comfortable, because it's this constant fight of fighting, being uncomfortable in my own skin and my own mind. So I just see a lot of similarities in those two things, with shame being the overwhelming thing. once you start taking medication, and you're, what I think is important to talk about is the combination of them. You know, I've had on a lot of different people on the podcast in dealing with first responders and veterans. And some people say, hey, listen, the VA was throwing around too much medication to people. We're doing more of a holistic thing. I have other people say, I have this way of doing it. And I think it's so important, and I feel just a responsibility to say that it is not one size fits all. And I liked in your talk that you said, hey, this, I had these tools, but it was this missing piece that really kind of brought everything together. Can you speak some more on that?
Yeah. And, you know, like I said, when I looked at it, and again, this is all, you know, I'm discovering this through, you know, Laura became more, in some ways, my psychologist. Yeah, I was listening now, you know, but I did have my own therapist. I had my own psychiatrist. And, you know, when I first got on medication, I did not like it. I did not, you know, it was not good. I didn't like what it was doing to my body. And finally, you know, I had a conversation with my psychiatrist, and I say, hey, listen, you know, the cure is killing me here. You know, I mean, I'm not thinking about hurting myself, but I'm apathetic. I've got all these other second and third order effects. And what she did, and this was Dr. Helen, I forget her name.
Knox.
You know, she said, okay, and she did a circle, and she drew a circle on a dry erase board. She says, okay, what we want to do, you know, here's in the middle, and we want to get you to the point where you still have creativity. You still have got to get to the very edge of that point. And we're going to figure out what gets you there. And because I told her, I said, I can't write anymore. I feel like I've lost this creative spirit. And she helped me get to that point. And once I got to that, and I got back, and that's when I started writing the book, when I started, you know, doing the Shakespeare and the moth talks. So, I mean, you asked about the moth. That was part of my, you know, my artistic recovery, because I think art helped me heal through this. And I've got to say that up front. My, you know, between my writing, my acting, and my public speaking was very important to my, you know, to my transitional recovery. But it got me to that point. And so over time, I'm not on medication now. You know, I meditate every day. I have a lot of healthy practices, and that's why I love your podcast and I love what you're doing. Habits, I've integrated a lot of good habits in my life. So I'm at that point, and it's taken 5 years, 6 years, however it was. And this was always back and forth with Laura and I, that I'm inculcated these other habits that have made me get better. And that's why I really love your podcast and what you're doing, JT.
Oh, thank you for the kind words. That's really nice of you to say. I like that you're talking about the balance of the medication, not necessarily the balance, that the fact that just because you take it, yes, you may have side effects, but this is a process that we're going to have to work with somebody who knows what they're doing, and we're going to get you to where you need to be. Your creativity, this is another thing, you know, it's not always associated with soldiers, right? Soldiers are kind of regimented in the way they're doing things. You're even talking about meditation. Again, can you imagine 15 years ago, a colonel talking about his meditation practices? I mean, this just isn't, this is a new time. Was that always something that had been in your arsenal? I mean, is that always something that's just kind of been around?
I'm pointing over to my savior here again, you know, and I'm going to let Laura, I started with yoga. Laura introduced me to yoga and then meditation. And she's the way, you know, again, when you talk about the toolkit, you know, it is, whenever I started to break it down, and this is, Laura's a veteran too. I didn't know if you know that. She was a captain of the United States Army, got out as a major, and now she's a GS civilian. But, you know, we started having these battle buddy talks about, okay, you know, this is like in the military, or this is a, you know, a battle drill, you know, this is something, how do I react to this instance? And she would say, well, have you tried breathing? Have you tried, you know, drinking water and being mindful about drinking? Hey, right. Let's try this yoga thing. I'm not going to do this yoga thing. Yeah, and she, you know, Laura is a 200, 400 hour yoga certified person. Wow. So I started doing that. And then it's getting back into those habits, started journaling and all those things. So, you know, again, Laura can talk about how yoga and mindfulness has you've implemented that at Fort Knox.
Right. Well, I mean, my introduction to mental health was I don't even know, 1996, I think. I was in the Army, and I had a lot of anger issues, and so I was basically command-directed to mental health because I threatened to kill another captain in front of all the inmates on the tier because he was wrong. And so I got to go spend some time with a psychologist, which was horrifying in 1996. But he said, have you tried yoga? And have you tried not maxing your PT test? Can you just kind of relax your standards? And I thought he was crazy. And then 3 months later, I was addicted to yoga and could never let myself not max the PT test. But, you know, it was, you start finding ways to give yourself some space and some grace and to relax, you know, the expectations. Because that's another part of this. You know, if you're talking about shame and you have unreachable expectations, that fuels shame.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think, you know, but I started doing yoga. And then when I got, I'm just a very holistic practitioner. I believe that people should spend about 8 sessions with me before we start talking medication, because I really do believe that I've got to get your lifestyle different. You know, soldiers are routinely fueled on caffeine, nicotine, and alcohol.
It's insane.
And that is the 3 food groups, right? I mean,
it's insane to me that that's going on for as long as it has. And no one is talking about, or maybe they are now, but the true effects that this is having. Take combat out of it. You live a life on those stimulants, and then you're depressant at night. You know, I'm the first to say, you know, I drank before I went in the military, but man, if you want to surround yourself with a crew where you won't feel a lot of shame for drinking copious amounts, man, enlist, because you're going to have some drinking buddies. And those coping mechanisms, whether it's celebrating, whether it's grieving, whether it's just you're hanging with your friends, when you get out and that identity of being in that group is gone, but you still continue those same coping mechanisms, man, that is not serving our soldiers, our airmen, our sailors. It's really, it's unfortunate. And, but that's, I could go on for that for a while, but I like the fact of you can connect. I'm always trying to, and this has been my mission here, is connecting actions with emotions, whether you're conscious of those or not, right? So you're feeling shame. Well, what is it you're feeling shame from? Well, it's these actions. On the flip side, it's making that connection between those daily habits, those positive things, and then the positive emotions, that feeling of self-pride, the feeling of healing in ways that I don't think is talked about near enough, especially within the veteran community.
Yeah. You know, the one of the things I recognized, and, you know, Brene Brown has a saying that says, you know, grace is when your mistakes serve a purpose instead of serving shame. And so, you know, finding that purpose, you know, and I know a lot of, you know, I love Brene Brown. I think she's done amazing work about vulnerability, which was kind of the center of, you know, why I wanted to tell this talk. Because telling that talk, I didn't realize that the problems it would eventually cause, you know, it continued the shame, you know, and embarrassment of my wife and my daughter. My daughter came home, Dad, I saw you on TV. I didn't, you know, I didn't even think about that, right? All I was thinking about, okay, I've got to get this story out because I don't want somebody to do what I did. I mean, that's the bottom line, is that, you know, that story was about, you know, trying to pay it forward. And so, you know, and that became my purpose for a while, is figuring out, okay, how can I, you know, help other folks? And it still is. I still get, you know, people. I got somebody, you know, emailed me today, you know, from read my book and said, hey, I, you know, this has really helped me. Can we talk? And so, you know, I sent an email back. So I still get, that's still a very important part of my life as well.
It's service that, work. It's a form of service work where you feel that need. You know, I think of it as, and I've said it before, and I'm not sure if it was on the one with General Martin, but it's a feeling of empathy when you start to distance yourself from that version of you that was so uncomfortable, was in so much pain. You want to help others, because you know what that suffering is. Not only do you know what that suffering is like, but you know that there's a world after this. You know, to simplify it, and I've told this, I'm sorry if amount of people have heard this before, but you know, if someone told me they hurt their back before I had back surgery, I was like, yeah, whatever. You got, you're gonna have to put up with it. I have a couple back surgeries. Someone tells me they hurt their back, I want them to sit down. I'm gonna tell them all the techniques I use to help them. How, you know, you mentioned yoga, but how did that even come to be where you said, I'm going to stand in front of people? Because this was almost like the moth. I'm picturing almost like an open mic thing where you're kind of showing up and you're going to tell a story.
Yeah.
How did you come to that? How did you come to the idea that this is what I'm going to do?
Well, that's a great, we have a program here in Louisville called the Moth Story Slam. So every Tuesday, you know, it is an open mic where, you know, everybody puts their name in a hat. It's a theme. The theme of the one that I did that you heard was Now or Never. You know, come up with a story, a 5-minute story. It's got to be between 5 and 6 minutes long. Then you have people judge you. You know, I mean, it's the old, it's like Olympic, you know, 10, you know, 4, whatever. And so I started doing these because I'd met, I was at the time working with, I was a fundraiser for the Fund for the Arts. And I met this lady, Tara Anderson, who's actually a Jeopardy winner, but she was the NPR and she was the host of the show. And she says, why don't you come on and talk, you know, because I was doing some stuff with the arts. And I said, I'll do it. And so I just started going on. And one night, I think I did about 7 or 8 of them and I won. And that allowed me to go to the Story Slam, which was a competition for, you know, so you can get your story out, you know, on public radio, which is what you heard.
Yeah.
But just telling the stories, and I just started telling stories, and I really enjoy doing it. You know, I love, you know, it's an important part of my life because I think storytelling has been a significant part of my transition, helping with my transition and my recovery and all that as well.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you're fantastic at it. And there is a dopamine hit from, I do stand-up comedy on the side, and there is a dopamine hit from standing up there and telling the story and feeding off that reaction from the audience. It's fun. I definitely enjoy that. So Laura
and I met using stand-up comedy as well.
What's that?
So we had this really weird kind of, you know, early relationship. The first night we met, we went, I kept seeing this girl in a gym and she was, you know, on the Stairmaster sweating and all this kind of stuff. And I said, man, she's really hot, you know? And
yeah.
So I go to this little place on where we're stationed at Fort Leavenworth. And there she is with her non-commissioned officer. She's a company commander at the prison there at the disciplinary barracks. She's a military police officer. And I'm thinking, hey, I'm going to ask this, you know, this beautiful girl to play pool with me because I'm a great pool player. Me and a buddy. So I ask her and she says, oh yeah, I'll play. And so I'm up there and I'm giving her pointers. Hey, this is really how you need, this is what you need to do. And she says, she looks at me and we're playing 8-ball and I'm really a competitive dude. And she says, you know what? I just want to hit my favorite color. And I said, well, what's your favorite? Black. And so she hit the black in and we lost the game because it was 8-ball. And then she took it and then she went in and she ran the rest of the balls on the table.
I love it.
And then she looked at me. She dropped the stick and she says, don't ever talk down to me again, Sporto.
Yes.
And so, you know, there it was. And 6 weeks later, we were married.
Unbelievable.
Literally.
Unbelievable. What a great story. That's fantastic.
Yeah. I had to, but.
I used to be cool.
But she was doing stand-up comedy too when we met, so it was just great. It just reminded me of the story of our long courtship.
Hey, if you don't mind, you know, you said you had this overwhelming, this compelling feeling to start sharing all of this almost before everyone was on board with this being told. And this is probably a question for you, Laura. What was that like to have these things that are kind of intimate within your family, to see your loved one who's suffering through this, but now kind of opening the doors to the world of you know, some really personal things?
For me, you know, my job is I'm the director of psychological health for Fort Knox.
Right.
So I sit in all of the high-level meetings You know, and I walked into one meeting and there was a sidebar conversation going on about that colonel that got a DUI. And it was a pretty negative story. It was pretty, people were being very unkind.
Sure.
And I said, hey, listen, stop talking because I'm here. You know, let's judge freely here.
Yeah.
You know, I want to hear what you got to say. And maybe we ought to offer him some help. Maybe that's what we should do.
Yeah.
But, you know, that takes a lot of courage. And, of course, you know, I did want to run out of the room and go cry in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. But you just, you know, you put your mask on and you just kind of. But I took it from that point of I can sit back and wallow in self-pity or embarrassment, or I can use this as a platform to say even colonels with stable home lives who are married to psychologists can fall apart.
Yeah.
And so if there's anybody who should, you know, have all these supports and all, you know, we in the military, everybody has a family, a paycheck, everybody has health care. We're still really vulnerable. We're just human beings who are vulnerable. And so it just kind of, it gave me a unique perspective.
Something that comes to mind is not only are we human and we're vulnerable just because we're soldiers, but that doesn't mean we're not human. It's almost more dangerous or worse than the fact that we're humans and we are in an environment where talking about something like this is considered a weakness. You know, I've talked to other people and this would be veterans and first responders and people that will kind of confide to me and they say, hey, I don't want to come out with this because of how it, you know, shows that I've got an issue or I'm weak. I said, no, the difference is weakness is continuing to do this same thing and not changing. Like you owe it to yourself. You owe it to your loved ones. You owe it to your family members. You owe it to your career, to everything, to actually have the strength to make a change.
It takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of courage. And it's, you know, there's this whole philosophy of most of us would rather avoid pain than seek pleasure, you know? And so we're just going to not talk about it. We're going to stuff it down and we're just going to ignore it because it's too much work and it's too scary to change or to address it.
Coming from a spouse, I would imagine people have reached out to you. And one of the reasons I really wanted to have you on here is what is that? Well, you have your own tipping point, but to mix being a spouse and then your what you do for a living, what would advice be to you to other people maybe living in a household with somebody? And this doesn't have to be a veteran. This could just be somebody because obviously, again, the military doesn't have a monopoly on trauma. But what, you know, talking to somebody about what that tipping point is and how to try and get their spouse to get some help.
You know, I think if we're going kind of segueing from what you were talking about with the substance abuse, you know, issues and misuse, the concept of an intervention mm-hmm. is powerful because like I said, you know, for years I had talked to Fred about, well, I think, you know, this anger, you know, you're having some issues with this. I think this would be helpful. But my lone voice, there wasn't an impact. It's just Laura thinks this. Mm-hmm. So I think if you can get other people on board, and a lot of times with the military, you have commanders or first sergeants or, you know, friends or family. And if you can get a lot of folks on board, it's that unified voice of there is something going on, but more importantly, we love you and we want to get you help.
Yeah.
Not the, you're all messed up.
Yeah. One of the messages I think is always important to keep too is the empathy behind that. It's very hard. I think one of the biggest issues with dealing with mental health is the way it interacts or the way it comes out in a personal relationship that it's very easy to hurt feelings. So if Fred, you're hurt in a certain way, but it's, you know, it's not between the ears, it's a physical thing. It's much easier for Laura to go, I feel bad for you. You're because it's not you lashing out. It's not showing anger and making, you know, trying to make other people miserable around you. So, I don't even know what my point of that is, but trying to tell family members or remind them of that. Like, hey, this is all a sign of pain. This is all a sign of discomfort. And we need to try and remember that right up until the point you get a call from jail. And then you got to say.
And I do think it's hard because even as a psychologist, I don't want to mislead anybody. I'm a real jerk. I was mean to Fred, mm-hmm. you know, and I was not feeling compassion or empathy when he called me from jail. I was mad.
Sure.
And, you know, I said some pretty miserable things. And so I'm a trained psychologist and I can be really,
yeah.
So without that understanding that there's neurochemical stuff going on and that there was a brain change and, you know, his gut probably wasn't producing enough serotonin either because there was a lot of alcohol flowing. So, you know, just even with all that information, I was still a very wounded wife. Mm-hmm. And so I reacted in a very wounded wife way. Whereas if you have that intervention, every individual who is having to courageously say, this is how you hurt me, is supported.
And if I could take something in addition to that, JT, is our daughter, which I cannot, we can't have this discussion without talking about the children who I think are the real victims of this war. You know, I chose to be a soldier. My wife knew what she was getting into when she married me. My daughter did not, you know, raise her hand in the womb and say, y'all support and defend the United States. Right. So my daughter is, her resilience broke down over time. You know, I think, you know, when I look back, when I finally came, because she didn't know about this, the incident, the first time I think she heard about it was whenever
the book got released.
When the book got released. Mm. And then the TED Talk and the other things and the Moth Hour, but she struggled, you know, throughout the time that she was in high school. And finally, we go to family therapy with a very brilliant. You could talk about this brilliant family therapist, and we had that discussion. That was a huge turning point in our lives as well. Mm-hmm. So the children, like I said, I can't say this enough. The children of veterans or people that struggle, or anyone that struggles with mental illness or PTSD or anger, are victims.
Mm. There's value in seeing a parent struggle with something and making a change. A lot of times the kids don't see that. You know, a lot of times kids look up to their parents and they go, hey man, they got it figured out. Well, you know, right up until about 16 and then you don't know crap. But up until that point, I mean, and this was my own experience of having to put out there, hey, I'm flawed. I'm struggling in this and I need to make this change. And that's not a role I was used to making. So when you make that, you feel very vulnerable in that. But I think there's a true power in a child seeing that, going, hey, like you can actually make a change as someone, as an adult. And I think it's a really important lesson. But going back to your point, I agree. There's, unfortunately, I'm sure there's not near enough kids seeing that transformation in front of them. And they're feeling the consequences of you know, the military life since 2001. So it's a true tragedy. Let's talk about how you got into what you're doing now. Because this is about as far from a military life. And how did you decide that this is what I want to do? I mean, how did this just kind of come to you post-military? Was this part of your recovery process?
Yeah, you mean teaching school, being a school teacher, or just the whole?
All of it. Teaching school, the Shakespeare for Veterans, the Moth, all of that.
Yeah. You know, I think I was trying to find that, you know, I was doing all the things that I really enjoyed. I mean, I enjoyed literature, I enjoyed, you know, Shakespeare, I enjoyed the arts. But I think it got back, and you said it early on, JT, it's the service thing. Is this purpose, you know, that Brené Brown talks about, is that I really just want, I'm trying to get to heaven. How can you spend time with these sixth graders, seventh graders? I mean, I just want to get to heaven, because I've done, you know, some things that I regret, but the way I feel best, and is serving, you know, again, you know, I'm a volunteer for Restorative Justice, which is a program that helps kids in trouble. You know, I'm a teacher, and it feels good to do good, and, you know better, do better. And that's kind of what, I just try to seek these opportunities. Now I'm a volunteer mentor for Operation Socrates, which is a program that brings veterans into teaching. So now, because the problem, when I came into teaching, man, that's a whole other story. I about had some triggers. I said, oh my God, this is not like combat. It's harder than combat. These little minions running around. But feeling like you're making a difference has, you know, and I don't know what hormone or what that brings up in my brain, but it makes me feel good whenever I do good. And so I just keep trying to find, you know, I'm hunting for the good. What can I do good, you know? And this meditation thing that I've really started, I'm on like 6 months. I've meditated at least 10 minutes a day now. And, it, you know, my mantra is, you know, be a positive presence in the universe. You know, how can I be, bring on, because I was not positive for a long time, you know?
I've talked about it before. It's a strange thing that the idea of service work, how you're doing something for others, and it's such a selfish thing because of how it makes you feel about yourself. I mean, it's like this win-win. we just hear what started as a podcast is now transformed into a nonprofit, and we're happy to say that we just finally got our 501c3 tax exemption status, and our idea is to do, you know, these events. So maybe everyone shows up at a state park and we talk about habits, we talk about meditation, we talk about mindfulness, and then we do service work. We clean, we do something that's bigger than ourselves. So it's that mix of doing something personally and then turning your attention to something else bigger than you, and then associating that with or connecting it with how you feel about yourself, because it is a big difference. I'll lean on you, Laura. What's your thoughts on that? Why do you think that is, what it's doing to ourselves? Is it just self-pride? What is it?
I think that it's that reach towards self-actualization. Mm. I don't think anybody gets up in the morning and says, I want to go be a crappy human being. Right. All deep down want to be good.
Yeah.
Striving to do good. And, you know, I might have a job that I hate. I might have a mortgage that's too high. I might have children that are unruly. But if I can go out and if I just pay for the Starbucks, which is such a, you know, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm gonna pay that $10 for the cup behind me.
Right. You
know, it makes us feel good because we've put a little bit of goodness. So again, for those junior attorneys, we're searching for the evidence. There's evidence that I'm doing good. Mm. There's evidence that I am going to self-actualize, that I'm going to rise above whatever my circumstances are. You know, part of the reason people turn to drugs and alcohol is you want to talk about hitting that GABA where you feel relaxed. You know, it goes right to it until it doesn't. Right. But, you know, it goes right to it. And so sometimes these little positive interactions that we have with people do that same thing. It goes right to that feel good center of our soul.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that it just really is human nature. We want to be connected. We're social human beings. If the pandemic taught us nothing else, it taught us that we really want to talk to that cranky neighbor and our, you know, not so nice coworker. We miss them.
Sure.
Right? So we're looking for that interaction. We're looking for purpose, and we're looking for positivity, despite some of our bad moods sometimes.
Yeah, it is powerful, and getting back to the meditation is, you know, I connect it to. We are in this constant phase right now where we're distracted. And maybe I'm wrong, but I just think that the ability to be distracted has never been easier, you know, and mostly because the phones here or whatever it is. And there is something powerful to pushing those things away and kind of sitting in your own feelings, your own mind. And like you said, you know, if I'm projecting positivity, I'm trying to bring good to the universe, man, it is It is something we need to be doing more of. And unfortunately, it just doesn't light the stuff up the same way all those negative things do. But the juice is worth the squeeze if we just keep going after it. Just keep going after it. So,
yeah. And the more you do it, I mean, particularly with the meditation, I have literally, I mean, that's been the, these last 6 months, Laura and I are, because Laura's been meditating far longer than I have, but I can see myself, the big thing is, seeing yourself before you make a bad decision or before, that negativity starts to creep in, you can take a breath. You can bring your mantra, you can bring it to your center and just say, and the more you practice it and getting back to the consequence of habits, the more you practice it, immediately, okay, I'm really getting angry. Okay, breathe, and boom, I'm in that place where, I'm smiling, okay, it's all good. Nobody's shooting at me.
I read something on Facebook that said, anything worth doing is worth doing poorly. And I have really, that resonates so much with me because I've been meditating for years and I'm terrible at it, right? But it's that habit, that showing up and meditating poorly. It's okay.
Yeah.
I did it. It's brushing your teeth poorly is way better than not brushing your teeth,
Yeah.
And it's especially when we find ourselves in those funks or those low parts of life, just, get up and go for a 5-minute walk. Just do it poorly.
Yeah.
And it's that habit. It is that habitual showing up for yourself.
Consistency, just doing it on, and man, no one is more, should be more invested in doing something that than yourself. It's crazy. Have you guys tried any of the breath work before? Any like the Wim Hof kind of thing? The it doesn't sound like I can, but your blank stares are telling me.
Oh no, we could just be frozen.
Yeah, it's true.
Just the breath work I've done is with like the yoga breathing, the breath of fire, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I'm a simple girl. I breathe in, I breathe out.
Yeah. I mean, I do the box breathing. I don't know. I'm not familiar with what you're saying. So, I mean, I do experiment with it.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, maybe when we're off, I had another veteran on and he's a Navy guy and they were working. He now owns a company called Stasis, but these were all SEALs. And one of them was training for an Ironman or something. And there's a breathing technique. And he started doing this breathing technique. He found, oh my God, it's doing amazing things for my stress. And it has now just taken it into now it's getting out of the Navy and starting a company. And it's not too far off from just following your breath. It's got some, anytime I explain it, I feel like people kind of check out because it gets a little funky at points, but right. I'll send it to you. I'm not even going to tell you about it. But listen, guys, I don't know if there's something else you want to cover. I've already taken an hour of your time here and this has just been an awesome conversation. These are the types of conversations I wish we were having more of.
Okay. Is there anything?
The thing I always, therapy, the word therapy, the term psychologist is terrifying. Mm-hmm. It's scary. It's intimidating. And so I usually tell people, think of me like I'm your coach, or even my better analogy is I'm the Sherpa. Nice. I've been up that mountain a lot of times. I can carry the rock this time. And then I always charge my folks, because I have a lot of senior military officers that are my patients. I charge them. I said, now you go be a Sherpa for someone else. But the mountain you're going to bring them up is coming to us, coming to get therapy, to get that help. So I think I would like to destigmatize the concept of therapy, because it really is teaching habits, teaching that you have control of your life, that every moment of your day you make a decision.
Awesome. Awesome. And I agree. I think there's a responsibility in somebody who finds relief that they have to spread that message, that it's selfish just to take this and not try and help others. So 100%. Guys, thank you so much for taking some time out of your day. And I'm going to edit all these little glitches out of here. This is going to be smooth as butter when we're all said and done. And This, if you ever have anything you want to come back on and discuss, just consider this a platform that's always open to you guys. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much. It was an honor. I appreciate it. Thanks, JT. Appreciate it, man.
All right, everybody. That's it for me. Thanks to Fred and Laura Johnson for coming on, telling their story. I appreciate you guys giving us a listen, and I hope you guys all have an awesome week.